University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Norris Alfred, editor-publisher of the Polk Progress in Polk, Nebraska. Alfred's lecture is entitled Progress, Polk Style. Last spring, Alfred was named Master Editor-Publisher by the Nebraska Press Association. A 1980 Pulitzer Prize nominee, Alfred has owned the Polk Progress for nearly 35 years. In his weekly editorial column for the Progress, titled Polking Around, Alfred covers subjects ranging from his political opinions to his love for bird watching. Every now and then, he mixes in a little weather report. The Progress's motto, Slower is Better, is emphasized by the fact that Alfred uses an 1890 model Babcock Standard Hot Metal Letterpress to print the paper. It is currently read by about 900 subscribers in 45 states. Join us now for Norris Alfred and University Forum.
No, I've never listened to myself being described, you know, and it's sort of embarrassing. But I got a talk here. It isn't really a talk, it's a reading. And then this morning, before I got up, last night I was thinking in bed, there should be some kind of introduction to this reading. So this morning I got up about 4 o'clock and got down the typewriter. And I wrote out this for an introduction. And from my Progress perch, I have been studying the residents of Polk and the community for more than 30 years and have stumbled upon a great truth, which I think will lose none of its greatness when extrapolated to include all of Nebraska, the United States, and the world. People can be divided into two basic groups, talkers and listeners. I was born a listener. You may well wonder why I'm standing here talking. I have two reasons. First, I don't listen so good, which is how the Progress Swedish philosopher described the behavior of a small great-granddaughter who had accompanied her to Sunday church services. She sat so good. My hearing is deteriorating. Second, listeners can be divided into writers and non-writers. I have spent the past 30 years writing. Talkers like to hear themselves talk. Writers like to read what they write. This presentation I am about to inflict on you has been written with every I dotted and every T crossed. The sentences have been carefully strung with words judiciously selected for maximum effect. For example, I eliminated all the yeah, you bets, which is the stock answer in Polk to all assertions about the weather, Polk inhabitants, or the state of the world. Yeah, you bet is total agreement and leaves no opening for continuing conversation. And this morning I have much to say, so I have eliminated it from this reading because I am contracted to talk for 50 minutes. For every minute less than 50, a deduction is made in the fee. For every word uttered beyond the 50 minutes, I am fined a similar amount. Yeah, you bet. I'll soon begin my reading, which is loaded with quotes. The most quotes come from the Polk Progress Swedish philosopher. My late friend, farmer and hog raiser, Clarence Erickson of Hordeville, is also quoted, as is my late friend and compatriot, Ralph Kaler. Then there are quotes from some minor characters, Lorne Nisley, who was not a hog raiser, E.F. Schumacher, who was an astute philosopher and whose quotes are on a level with those of the Progress Swedish philosopher, and that is praise indeed. That's probably enough for an introduction to the main manuscript. Did I hear you say, yeah, you bet? When I agreed to this appearance and talk, I had no idea what to say, only that there would be a desperate need to say something and to continue talking for a minimum of 50 minutes. I sought inspiration, as I have many times before, in my list of quotes from the Progress Swedish philosopher Alvina Lind. She is now one of the Progress folders. The paper is hand-folded. But for years was a Progress correspondent reporting the Mr. and Mrs. visiting Mr. and Mrs. local news, which I have in unguarded moments described as local news. At 82 years of age, Alvina is still active and loves to talk. The other folders are her daughter, Norma Rodine, and her daughter-in-law, Thelma Lynn. It was cold this morning. I have described them as a great-grandmother, a grandmother, and a mother without great or grand degree. One folding day, Norma criticized Alvina with, "Mother, you talk too much." The Progress Swedish philosopher fired back, "If I don't talk, I never say anything." Reason for talking cannot be more succinctly stated. This combined with her comment on sympathizing with a friend over loss of a loved one, "It doesn't matter so much what you say, just that they say something," provides horizon-wide guidelines determining both quality and quantity of this talk. A continuation of a hope I've entertained for more than 30 years of saying something. I can't recall ever having had an uncontrollable urge to publish a weekly newspaper. As a printer pressman, I worked in the back shops of letterpress weeklies and never envied the personnel in the front office with the glamorous writing jobs. I was also able to resist with minimum effort reading what they wrote after I printed it. A disastrous combination of circumstances shoved me into ownership of a weekly newspaper, and I've been unable since to call my soul my own. The publisher I was working for in my hometown, Polk, Nebraska, wanted to buy a larger weekly in a neighboring town and offered to sell the hometown paper for $9,000, $3,000 down, and $100 per month to pay off the balance with no interest charge. After several years of wandering around the United States as a country printer and watercolorist, I had accumulated experience but no cash. A brother-in-law had accumulated cash and maybe wanted the experience of lending some to his wife's brother as an experiment to discover if there was something worth saving in tramp printers. I had sacrificed a dim future and returned to my hometown to help my parents, who were aging and having difficulty coping with the ailments of the elderly, including financial problems. Circumstances dictated I should settle down and amount to something, though the opportunity that Polk Progress presented was not golden. In August 1955, I became editor-publisher-owner plus pressman, printer, linotype operator of the Polk Progress with more fear of than hope for the future. The population of Polk was listed as 430 on the Highway 66 sign posted at the village limits, and I suspected that total had been promotionally inflated by the commercial club. The only joy in my first years with the Polk Progress was keeping the floor clean. This was easy. I swept the room back and forth, and the dirt fell through the cracks between the floorboards. Since the basement had a dirt floor, the sweepings blended in perfectly. I bought a fire insurance policy on building and contents for more than enough to cover what I owed and entertained the hope at times the building would catch on fire. Then I was prepared to act as my late friend Ralph Kaler, proprietor of the coffee shop, said he was. If the coffee shop caught fire, he planned to stand in front of it with a shotgun and prevent the volunteer firemen from putting it out. When I acquired the Progress business, I was 42 years old and lacked wisdom. I was brought up on the ethic that if I worked hard and kept my nose clean, the blessings of life would descend on me. This was guaranteed. I had sung about the glories of working through the noon hour while as a boy attending church services and was thoroughly imbued with the notion of work as healthy, mentally and physically stimulating and rewarding. Instead of blessings, what descended on me were drips from a leaking roof. I was slowly realizing I hadn't purchased a substantial building. I've never been inclined to make snap judgments, but the gradual buildup of unpleasant facts about the Progress office, equipment and business fed a growing suspicion I had been had. I was saddled with debt, a precarious business in an unsubstantial building, and planned to publish a newspaper each week with a 1913 linotype and an 1890 big cylinder Babcock press. It appeared impossible. Then John Holtman, a Swedish bachelor farmer living northeast of Polk, came in to renew his subscription, remarking, "I better pay for 2 years. Then I won't have to come to town so often. Now, I knew my wandering days were over. I had to stay and provide John Holtman with a progress for 2 years. Subscription checks are contracts of faith. I kicked the traveling bags into the darkest corner of the closet and gained my first bit of wisdom. My future was not somewhere beyond the 360 degrees of Polk, Nebraska's wide horizon. That takes care of how I acquired the progress printer, what I acquired, and when it happened. But it doesn't fully account for the why. Basically, I had no roots outside of childhood and Polk. The romanticism of wandering, wondering, and watercoloring rapidly palled. I needed people, friends, acquaintances, pals, and all that accrues in the gregarious congeniality of community life. I had rejected all of that in an attempt to be another John Mirren watercolorist with a dash of Paul Klee, and I lacked the necessary talent. All I had was an admiration and an intense desire to explore the fewness of essentials needed for creativity and art. The fewness of essentials needs explanation. John Mirren had the innate ability to make one line or one brushstroke depict a multiplicity of meaning. There is a thrust, a creative force to his paintings, and the best ones were painted with a minimum of line and brushings. This frugality of means can be found in writing, particularly poetry. E.B. White, my favorite writer, revised a little book, The Elements of Style, written by his friend and teacher at Cornell, William Strunk Jr. White wrote in the introduction to the revision, describing the little book. It's a 43-page summation of the case for cleanliness, accuracy, and brevity in the use of English. "Omit needless words," cries the author on page 17, and into that imperative, Will Strunk really put his heart and soul. So there you have it. "Omit needless everything," cries the Polk Progress editor. There is an economy of belief. My late friend and teacher, Reverend J.F. Balzer, minister of the Congregational Church at Crete, Nebraska, and member of the Doane College faculty and administration at various times, preached a sermon on the fewness of things one must believe. Beginning with, not long ago, while we were having our kitchen remodeled to make more storage space, one of the painters entered the room and set up his ladders. He surveyed the room critically and then peered into the new cupboards. "It's the same everywhere," he said. "Too many things. The more cupboards, the more things. It doesn't pay." Much of our life is spent taking care of things, dusting, polishing, fixing, storing, providing the space, whether a building, room, cupboard, shelf, or a garage for a car. There is an approved neatness in having things properly stored, a place for everything, and everything in its place. This need for order is caused by the multiplicity of things. Things tend to overwhelm, and we quickly lose control by allowing innocent clutter to grow into massive litter. The Utney Reader, which describes itself as providing the best of the alternative press, declared in its issue of July-August 1989 that we have too much stuff. Molly Evans, author of Too Much Stuff, Our Accumulating Crisis, wonders, why do you own a slow cooker so you can cook stuff slower and a microwave so you can cook stuff faster? Also from that issue of the Utney Reader, I gleaned a quote from Thoreau's Walden. Things are in the saddle and ride mankind. And another, the advice of William Morris, a 19th century English poet, designer, textile artist, and socialist agitator. Have nothing in your home that you do not know to be useful or beautiful. Of course, this is not advice for the homeless. One necessary strategy for keeping things out of the saddle is to limit possessions. The Progress Swedish philosopher states, I hate having things stand around. They just fall down. Things also fall apart, don't work, blow up, pollute, destroy, and drive man further and further from his natural beginnings until the question arises, how human is man? Much of what I'm saying about things is being quoted from a Progress editorial of January 9, 1975, Kicking the Can. The Question of Man's Humanity is the title to a lecture, one of six in a book, The Firmament of Time, by the late Lauren Isley, anthropologist, naturalist, science philosopher, and one-time Nebraskan. Modern man is being swept along in a stream of things, giving rise to other things at such a pace that no substantial ethic, no inward stability has been achieved. Such stability as survives, such human courtesies as remain, are remnants of an older Christian order. That condemnation of modern man was made in 1959, and the Balzer Sermon was probably written in the late 1930s or early 1940s. We quote these men because the growing problem they point out has become more acute and potentially disastrous during the intervening years, until we are now running out of space to store the trash of our things. One more Isley quote, and I'll kick around some of the thoughts it inspires as the boy kicks a can ahead of him on a walk. Isley wrote, "It is with the coming of man that a vast hole seems to open up in nature, a vast black whirlpool spinning faster and faster, consuming flesh, stones, soil, minerals, sucking down lightning, wrenching power from the atom, until the ancient sounds of nature are drowned in the cacophony of something that is no longer nature, something instead which is loose and knocking at the world's heart, something demonic and no longer planted, escaped it may be, spewed out of nature, contending in a final giant's game against its master." I read that while on a plane returning from a Christmas visit to New Orleans. And certainly, the ancient sounds of nature are drowned in the jet roar of rapid travel, proof of the rightness of the writing. Behind me in New Orleans, I had seen the incredible crud of the city allowed to accumulate by a non-caring people who sped past the litter in shiny automobiles, hearing only the muffled roar of the motor as it effectively drowned out the cry of the land. Balzer's sermon, "The Fewness of Things One Must Believe," caused me to consider the fewness of things one needs. Just don't cast out the weekly newspaper. Of course, needs vary, and doing without shouldn't become a religious conviction. As part of the Polk Progress entertainment, I wrote in my front page column, Poking Around, a monthly report on the meetings of a fictitious Polk Bachelors Club. Fictitious except for the members, who are all Polk bachelors, including the Progress editor, who assigned himself the job of secretary. The club met once a month as an organization dedicated to putting Bachelor's Day on the calendar. The club would annually organize a protest march on Father's Day. Not against fathers, after all, every bachelor had one, but as added emphasis on the need for a Bachelor's Day. I could stretch this account into a long story, including the club's recipe book, 101 Ways to Fry an Egg, and how we draped a member's chair with a black cloth if he died or married, considered equivalent events. But it is the thought of the fewness of things and one member of the Bachelor's Club who almost caused a permanent dissension that I want to relate here. One member remarked at a meeting that another member, Martin, absent at that particular meeting, had been wearing the same pair of pants for 6 months. And this member wondered if that was the only pair Martin had. The member was certain of his facts because the pants had a patch near the left back pocket. And surely Martin would not have two or more pairs of pants with a patch in the same place. The other members began watching Martin's pants. Discussion was held about buying him another pair, but some members thought Martin would consider this welfare. After all, bachelors are noted for sturdy independence, otherwise they wouldn't be bachelors. Some of the members were adamantly against buying Martin another pair of pants. Martin's pants began to rot the congeniality of the club. A few members developed a nervous twitch after months of looking at that pair of pants with the patch. I don't know what might have happened, but Martin spared the members further dissension by marrying a widow. The club's existence finally ended with the death or marriage of all the bachelors except myself. As a surviving member, I have fond memories of astounding conversations with my deceased brethren. The treasurer of the club was a lumberman until he and a brother sold the Polk business. One morning I encountered him in the post office. He always called me Ole, which was reference to the nickname tagged onto my older brother and his 6-foot cousin, Little Ole and Big Ole. "Ole," he said that morning in the post office, You should have been with me to Lincoln last night. I attended a lumberman's convention and a banquet and listened to Norman Vincent Peale give a talk. That man could sure talk. He talked so easy. He did it without thinking. That was years ago, but ever since I've admired that ability and have striven to acquire it. The trouble with thinking, it interferes with talking, and the vocal mix is almost incoherent. Writing and thinking are a congenial mix for me, and I spend most of my time writing and less talking. 12 years ago, I listened to a speech by the late E.F. Schumacher, author of Small is Beautiful, subtitled Economics as If People Mattered, while attending a prairie conference at Doane College, and came away alerted and concerned with what is happening. Schumacher stated in that Small is Beautiful address, "We have now, even in the U.S. alone, more scientists and technologists alive than in all previous human history put together." You may well ask what they are all doing. And the answer will be that they are solving problems. Then you might get really worried. Aren't we running out of problems? And they become very reassuring. No, don't worry about that. In fact, we have them bigger and better than ever before. Now, here again, one should step 12 paces away from this problem of more problems, look at it, and see what's going on. I mean, this surely is extraordinary to have all this problem solving and all this competence and all this activity. And yet there are more and more problems. I know there are some simple answers given to it. It's all political. It's all population, or it's the weather. But these answers surely cannot satisfy. So we have to ask again, what is behind all of this? And I would like to suggest it is the development of technology, and we have to take new thought and see if it has gone in the right direction. Schumacher had some wonderfully learned suggestions that it hadn't. One of them was that the increasing size had decreased comprehension, and the pace of technological change had become so rapid as to defy comprehension. We can't understand if we can't comprehend. That's why I concocted Slower is Better, placed it in the masthead of the Polk Progress, along with a scholarly-looking peering snail wearing a pair of glasses that an artist friend drew. What the technologists had accomplished is a system guaranteed to keep problem solvers busy from now to eternity. The solution to a problem is another problem. For example, the solution to the problem of going from here to there faster while seated was the automobile. And we all know how many problems that created. When atomic power was first generated and thought to be controlled, it was considered as solving the problem of the need for an abundant and dependable energy source. Well, we all know what happened. The spin-off from the solution of that problem has created so many problems, technologists will be happily supplied forever and a day. The technologists are working at solving problems without thinking. In the headlong rush to discover utopia, they are making the world hellish. Problems are increasing at a faster rate than the answers. As one of the weekly newspapers in Nebraska, with a regular, usually lengthy editorial, I've gained some notoriety in the state's weekly and daily press and elsewhere. The elsewhere resulted in being a member of a panel on editorial writing at a meeting of the International Society of Weekly Newspaper Editors in the spring of 1980 in Oregon, Illinois. In my talk, I again quoted the Progress Swedish philosopher, who is enthusiastic about doing and worries in a somewhat carefree way about the lazy, claiming they just sit and look. While telling about hiring two boys to clean up her yard after a windstorm, she pinpointed the only reasons we are doers. One boy likes to work and the other has to. Nobody has to write editorials. I have never determined to my satisfaction whether editorial writers are born or made. I have never heard a youngster express a wish to grow up and be an editorial writer. Fireman, farmer, policeman, lawyer, preacher, president, publisher, and other such mundane occupations, yes. Editorial writer, no. I like to write editorials, though I admit my enthusiasm evaporated when I inadvertently heard a tatter of talk in Sportsman's Bar. a well-to-do Polk farmer sitting in the next booth and not knowing I was within hearing, had been asked by a companion coffee drinker what he thought of Progress editorials. He answered, "I don't read the editorials." There was a pregnant pause while he collected his next thought about Progress editorials and then added, "Nobody reads editorials." He considered them as corn cob, necessary to the ear but worthless. Then again, I'm rewarded by other comment. The late Clarence Erickson, Progress subscriber and farmer who lived near Hordeville, a neighboring community, told me, "I like that damn little paper of yours. In the evening, I can sit down, open it up, and read like hell about people I know." I know Clarence read the editorials because after having spent considerable time in the aforementioned sportsman's bar, he came to the Progress office to explain a bit of history he thought I had confused in the week's efforts that mentioned slavery. "I hate slavery," Clarence declared. He rambled a bit, telling about the biblical Joseph and how his brothers had sold Joe into slavery and cut up his coat of many colors. Somehow that coat got mixed with the red coats at Valley Forge, and Abraham Lincoln freeing the slaves, but it all came together because there was Clarence standing on the sidewalk outside the Progress office in the sunshine of a summer afternoon, straightening out my thinking and inviting me to Sportsman's Bar. "Come on, I'll buy the beer." I have been writing editorials for more than 25 years, which I consider staying, obeying the Progress Swedish philosopher's edict that we have been put on this earth to do something. While lecturing the other folders, the editor, Barb the linotype operator and printer, and her two boys, the apprentice Stevie and the assistant apprentice Timmy, who were raised to school age in the Progress office, on the evils of sloth, she declared, "If you don't do anything, you get out of practice." Inspiration is necessary for writing editorials. One of my friends is a stout conservative Republican. Almost all my Polk friends are stout conservative Republicans because the Polk population is 99.4400% stout conservative Republican. And I only need recall my latest political argument and the words tumble out of the typewriter. I can toss in regressive, progressive, aggressive, mix it with fusion, diffusion, confusion, add military, monetary, cemetery, stir in a sprinkling of damn and dumb, and the result is an editorial reprinted to tasty, crusty contention on the 100-year-old Big Cylinder Babcock newspaper press. Editorials can be written statistically, satirically, scientifically, sarcastically. Sometimes the subject matter can be dissected and the parts pondered separately. Opportunities for dissection have increased with the election of my arch enemies, the Republicans, to the presidency. I have held my nose while dissecting such specimens as James Watt, former Secretary of the Interior during the early part of President Ronald Reagan's reign of error. I don't know what I'll do about editorials if the Democrats win a presidential election. I may need to emphasize other concerns. For example, authority guaranteed by might is fearsome. Whenever and wherever opposition comes to the right of might, we cheer the protesters. Confusion is generated when the right of might is mistaken as the might of right, until the thought gains credence, only the mighty know the right. With insistent stupidity, the United States military has lost credibility. This insistent stupidity is in their perpetual assertion that peace can only be guaranteed by military strength and the willingness to use it regardless. Of course, this strength must be great enough to overwhelm the enemy, and it never is, according to the Pentagon. This insanity of power generates permanent paranoia because the enemy is always considered as having more, until someone concocted the phrase balance of terror, which can be more accurately described as balance of error in U.S. international relations. The permanence of enmity is needed in this paranoid rationale. A permanent enemy is necessary because without one, Neither the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, nor the stealth bomber have a rational reality in a sane world. I hope we are sane. I hope we prefer peace to war. J. William Fulbright states in his book, The Price of Empire, why he thinks the Fulbright scholarships are important. The ethos that underlies the educational exchange program is the belief that international relations can be improved and the danger of war significantly reduced by producing generations of leaders who will have acquired some feeling and understanding of other people's cultures that people can find in themselves through intercultural education, the ways and means of living together in peace. He justifies this hope in Sigmund Freud's answer to Albert Einstein's query in 1932 about the prospects of mankind doing anything about war. In a responding essay, Freud concluded that there was perhaps not much hope for eliminating war, but such hope as there was lay in man's capacity for cultural development. Fulbright stated, that is quite consistent with the idea of exchanges to promote cultural development among people of different cultures. A freelance writer in San Francisco, Casey McCabe, wrote a story about the Polk Progress that appeared in the Sunday, December 25, 1988, San Francisco Chronicle Examiner. He titled the story, A Sane Voice from the Boondocks. As an aside, McCabe's parents operated the coffee shop on P Street here in Lincoln until they sold it this year. In his story, McCabe selected a bit of our writing from the middle of a Progress weather column, a regular feature, 100% accurate because it does not predict, but reports what the weather has been. McCabe quoted from the July 28, 1988 Progress, Democrats should defy determination to dominate and preach the gospel of concern, that degradation of humanity must end, that cruelty in thought is equal to cruelty in deed, that cruelty expressed in the creation and deployment of an AMX missile with a MIRV warhead is equal to firing it. The equivalence of thought and deed must be recognized before there can be a peace that fosters its equivalence, hope. Back to that 1975 editorial, Kicking the Can. The whirlpool Eisley wrote about is the result of something called progress, which is not necessarily a bettering of human prospects. That progress has been marked by an increasing of power ever since a human picked up a stick and marveled at the increasing reach and thrust. The search has been for more power. Potential power has always been there, in the wind, the water, the oil, the lightning, the coal, and what is now being utilized, the atom. Now man is looking longingly at the ultimate source, the sun, and dreaming of harnessing some of that power, though it may destroy him, as it can destroy his sight if he looks at it too long. The demonic aspect of this progress comes when control of the power is lost. Three Mile Island and Chernobyl are examples, or misdirected, the Vietnam War, plus allowing our admiration for power to replace our love for the earth. Power is treacherous, and too much glorying in it can be fatal, as many a speeding automobile driver has lived only long enough to realize. Tragedy is in store for those who regard power as superiority. If it is not already too late, we must become increasingly wary of the superiority power nurtures. We have conquered distance and lost our awe of faraway places. We no longer marvel at nature's power, but scheme to subdue it. Casually, we destroy marshes, pollute swamps, bulldoze forests and groves, level hills, ditch wetlands, and pave the surface of the earth until it seems credible to refer to the asphalt man as Eisley did when considering the humans who will populate the future. Giving the can another kick as we strolled through these thoughts, we considered what Balzer wrote. But man is more than a tool maker, maker of things. Aristotle speaks of him as a political animal, for he not only makes things, but institutions as well. He creates the state, the church, the school, the community. Here is the stability that Eisley refers to when he wrote, such stability as survives, such human courtesies as remain, are the remnants of an older Christian order. We are destroying that order by our fascination with power. Institutions are people, and the more we depend on power, the less need there is for people and their institutions. Power isolates us from each other, and the isolation fosters hostility that can only destroy. With a final kick, which sends the can into the litter of throwaways in the paved street gutter, we consider the nostalgia in letters to the editor from former Polk residents, who recall a more comprehensible, if not simpler, time when man was more natural. Their nostalgia is a form of protest. No longer can we depend on the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, to always be available and to always be wholesome. There is no thing to substitute for air, food, and water, no matter how we search for it. What the painter meant when he said, it doesn't pay, life isn't sustained by cupboards. For more than 30 years, I have watched from my progress perch as farms become larger and farmers fewer. I won't be around to watch the end of this development. That it has an end, I'm sure. I can only cuss the inhumanity of it. Cussing, using four-letter old English words, suffices in relieving tension, and I have used them frequently. With turn-of-the-century printing equipment for publishing a weekly newspaper, cussing is a safety valve, relieving frustrations and restoring equanimity. Without it, I'm certain I'd be either dead or crazy. The new style farming includes hog confinement operations. For a time, a young farmer had a confinement hog operation near but outside the village limits and only two blocks from my house. Polk is of a size that no matter where I'm standing outdoors in it, I can see beyond the village limits. When the wind was out of the south, an unpleasant odor was wafted to my nostrils. I complained about the smell while talking to the banker. He replied, "Don't complain, that's the smell of money." I replied, "No, it isn't. It's the smell of hog shit." I reported this conversation verbatim in next week's Progress, justifying use of the four-letter word as necessary to bring the banker back to earth. He had gone aloft on a flight of fancy aroma. I had to be more circumspect in my cussing while Stevie and Timmy, now 13 and 8 years of age, spent their preschool days in the Progress office. When Barb married and Stevie arrived on the scene, she didn't want to quit work. After a few weeks of taking the baby to a relative in Central City, 15 miles distant, I suggested she bring the baby to the Progress office. I'd do the babysitting if she did the work. After all, daycare centers were being provided by big firms hiring working mothers. What Barb and I did was turn the 25 by 30 foot Progress printery into a daycare center. Boxes of toys and hot cycles became as much part of their printing equipment as the type. One day I heard Timmy, at 4 years of age, explode with a hefty cuss word when he was frustrated at being unable to put something together and make it work. "Oh, I muttered, I've got to watch my cussing." Timmy had picked up the words from me. I substituted the Progress Swedish philosopher's gentle expletives, "Mercy, land sakes, goodness gracious," and was rewarded when Timmy come to me with some toy that wouldn't work, saying, "Goodness gracious, Norris, I can't make it go." I told Timmy, after I tried to make it go and couldn't, that some things are designed to frustrate. It's their sole purpose. We need frustrations, which is another word for limits. That was over Timmy's head, and when he suggested, "Let's box," I said, "Okay." When Timmy and I box, we throw boxes at each other. Big empty cartons that had held 2,500 or 5,000 envelopes. These empty cartons were kept stacked for our boxing sessions. The idea of limits has long been on my mind as farms became larger and farmers fewer, and the need for rural villages such as Polk lessened. Main Street businesses closed. A weekly newspaper depends on local advertising. As that became less and less, I could see the handwriting on the wall. The independent, locally owned rural weekly newspaper won't survive the technological changes that have impacted both farming and printing. As a dumb, stubborn Swede, I've managed to keep the Progress business solvent with the help of a Social Security check and by staying with letterpress, which is less costly than electronic cold type offset printing, the contemporary computerized method for publishing newspapers. With the exception of the press and camera work, no printing skills are needed for putting together a newspaper with the cold type process. Consequently, the ease of production invites absentee owner investment in chains of weeklies, with the resulting revenue drained from each community. This is true of all business chain operations. The Walmart mogul, who counts his fortune in the billions, is the most startling example of what has gone wrong with community commercial enterprise. It is no longer community-inspired, but profit-inspired. Of course, business must profit. What we have failed to consider are the socioeconomic limits. Without limits, laws, guidelines, frustrations, social and environmental no-nos, describe them as you will, a peaceful and profitable world of human beings is impossible. Ease of communication has failed to make us a better informed populace. What it has done is make us more susceptible to demagoguery. Almost daily, we are buffeted by those convinced they have a pipeline to the truth. The concentration of communication that has resulted from its instantaneous and worldwide scope has the potential to be disastrous. I have often said and written that Adolf Hitler would never have been able to change Germany into a fascist regime without the radio extending his vicious oratory beyond the range of his voice. What I am trying to tell you is beware uniformity of thought. This is the danger in worldwide instantaneous communication. The Progress Swedish philosopher regards with profound disdain those who mail Christmas cards all the same. She declares emphatically, "I like variety." What I have tried to demonstrate with a small, independently owned newspaper is this need for diversity. Chain newspapers tend to look alike and are alike in more than appearance. At one time, I faithfully attended state conventions of the Nebraska Press Association and listened to talks on subjects such as the correct makeup of a newspaper page. The fellow talking was enthusiastic about his subject as he probed into the more and more minute detail in page makeup. He was on the subject of subheads in a story, usually one line of bold-faced type, and said put 6 points of space before and six and after the subhead to make it stand out. If the subhead was that important, I thought it logical to ask, what did the subhead say? I got a look that told me what he was thinking. There's one in every crowd. Again, what I'm trying to tell you is beware uniformity of makeup, whether it is a newspaper page or your life. Democratic government stresses our individuality, our differences, and protects them with the Bill of Rights. Beware attempts to weaken those rights that protect our differences. We do not want to be as hybridized as a cornfield. While talking about a rural school picnic that began in a rainstorm and ended in sunshine, the Progress Swedish philosopher stated, "You never know how a day goes until it gets to the end," which is saying hindsight is more accurate than foresight. An editorial writer who goes out on a limb predicting what will happen should keep the PSP's observation in mind. It is much safer to report that what did happen. Politically, I'm quick to predict disaster, particularly with Republicans in charge of the White House. Her observation about the day's weather restrains me from declaring in black and white Republican failure. This can also be construed as cowardly. While waiting for my many expectations of Republican political disaster to materialize, I continue to view with something akin to horror what is happening to farming around Polk and also continue doing what I decided to do about it, go bird watching. I do this every Sunday morning and report the results in a Progress birding column. One spring day, I was in the Polk Cemetery watching a black pole warbler as it searched purposely, intently, a budding tree branch 3 feet above my head. The little bird was oblivious of my presence as it moved constantly and pecked at edible tidbits on leaf-bursting twigs. To that diligent devourer of nature's crumbs, I was another tombstone, albeit an enthralled one. I remained motionless as a grave marker, while observing that bit of the grand design go about its business of living. That black pole warbler was a small, lively chunk of the infinite variety of life on Earth, and I momentarily wondered about size and significance. That little bird wasn't concerned about nor even noticing me. To that black pole warbler, I was no account, insignificant. My death wouldn't upset its life. Would the bird's death upset mine? One bird's death would not be disturbing if the black pole warbler joined the passenger pigeon, Eskimo curlew, great auk, and seaside sparrow as an extinct species. That would be cause for worry. Every spring, the sight of migrating birds is reassuring. Just as green growth renews the spirit, so do spring warblers migrating north. Annoying uneasiness that human exploitation may be upsetting the planet's rhythms subsides with the spring migration. The little beasties survived another winter. The grand design is still intact. There is a grand design, a functioning, throbbing whole of which the black pole warbler is a part. That bird flew north and found food in a Polk Cemetery tree. Accidental? Not likely. That warbler demonstrated repetitious purpose in its hunger and unawareness of my presence. The repetition has been described as machine-like, but life is more than mechanical motion, honed to 10,000ths of an inch. Earth supports life that has hopes, love, and capacity to cope with the unexpected. Machines are monotonous, predictable, and wear out. With care and conservation, the Earth won't. One final remark. Time fills the measures of all existence and never overflows. Whether we have enough time to correct our environmental errors, that destruction of those vital connections that sustain us and fasten us to all Earth life and a livable future, I don't know. No one knows the measure of existence until time fills it. We are now aware of awesome man-made dangers to the planet and all life on it. Having discovered the connections by destroying them, which is uncontrolled research into our limitations, the future is not open-end. So I add one more condition necessary for preventing the planet from wearing out. It will take care, conservation, and contentment. Thank you for coming and listening.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Norris Alfred, editor-publisher of the Polk Progress in Polk, Nebraska. His presentation was entitled Progress, Polk Style. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts university located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 programs at the university.